Okay, thank you very much. Very special thank you for your presence here because of the special this weather, actually. Today, actually, I'll be talking briefly about some of the projects I've been involved in Los Alamos with Alan Perelson, and jointly, actually, this work is joint work with Rui Ribeiro, Living Wrong. They both are in Los Alamos, actually, in the same group, actually. So, outline of my talk, I will briefly explain about the HIV infection. Actually, HIV has a very, very huge research, so it's impossible to say anything about HIV in a brief. So it's so widely done, the research. But again, I would like to briefly say about the HIV. And mainly, I will discuss two parts. Focusing on the first part is focusing on primary phase, early phase, because they are quite different. They are completely different, primary phase and later phase. And there are still another phase in the middle, actually. That's a latent phase. So we won't be talking about that one, actually. Yeah. So chronic phase, I call it, actually, it's not chronic. Basically, I should have called it late phase, very late phase. So in the primary phase, actually, I will discuss this is a new model. We are just, it's a very, very simple extended form of the old model. It's time-dependent infectiousness theory. So we'll discuss that one. And using that model, we briefly discuss some optimal control problem. As I say, primary phase, in the primary phase for HIV, treatment is not given generally. Only that's given for the pre- or post-exposure prophylaxis. So in the primary phase, we'll discuss a little bit about that one. And this is latent phase, late phase, chronic phase. We'll discuss with the antiviral therapy. There are about 18, 19 antiviral therapies, drugs. But among them, we will basically focus on, there is only one fusion inhibitor drugs that has been FDA approved. So we'll discuss about this fusion inhibitors. And finally, we conclude with a brief summary. Okay. So HIV infection, actually we don't have to say much about HIV, it's very, very well known. This is very big problem in the world. So it's actually the virus which that can lead to the AIDS. So if we look at the HIV epidemiology, so WHO estimates that in 2007, 32.2 million people living with HIV and 2.5 million newly infected only in 2007, and 2.1 million AIDS deaths, including 330,000, so 330,000 children. So that's why there is still a huge burden of HIV in the world. So, and means of transmission, HIV transmits, primary route of transmission is actually sexual contact, and blood or blood products, blood transfusion or kind of things, and also there is a transmission from mother to child. So transmission probability, actually, I would just want to point out this little bit because it has to do little bit with the time-dependent infectiousness. We did that. Normally, transmission probability, of course, that depends on a route, sexual transmission or mother to child. So there are different probabilities. Even in the sexual transmission, so among the homosexuals, a female to male, male to male, male to female, so there are different probability of transmissions. Whatever it is, but generally it's assumed that to correlate with the viral load only. They just measure the viral load, they can measure viral load, and higher the viral load, larger the probability. Normally people have been using that kind of things. Now, if we look at the detailed immunology part, inside the body what happens, so this is the structure of HIV. And this is more or less a spherical shape, and it has the two proteins on the surface, GP120 and GP41, this length. And actually, this is GP120, when infection begins, actually this GP120 will, a main target cell of HIV is the CD4 T cells, so CD4 plus T cells, and that T cells has a CD4 protein, and to that CD4 protein, this GP120 protein binds. And from there, actually, infection starts. There are different stages. We'll discuss that too a little bit. And it has these two RNA. Each virus has the virion has the two RNAs. And actually, basically, when they measure the viral load, actually, they measure these RNA copies. How many RNA copies are there? Mostly per milliliter. Now, basically, main target of HIV is this mainly CD4 plus T cells. CD4 plus T cells are mainly responsible for the immune system. Yeah. They fight against the different diseases. HIV targets that CD4 T cells. When HIV infects the people, then there is a loss of CD4 T cells, and that's by different ways, by killing by virus. Virus itself can kill the CD4 cells. When it is infected, T cell die itself. Also there is a CTL, this is killer T cell, CD8 plus T cells get activated, and that kills the infected cells. Anyway, when people get infected with HIV, then there is a loss of CD4 plus T cells. Depending on how many CD4 plus T cells are counted, and depending on how many CD4 plus T cells a patient has, then we can say that what is the stage of the diseases, actually. That we can say, depending on the CD4 plus count, it's per microliters, actually, mmq. Per microliter, disease stage is normally, if more than healthy people can have normally 500-1,500. Generally, they call 1,200 or 1,000 per microliter. If more than 500, it's okay. This is not that bad. If it's 200-500, people try to show some symptoms. They start to show some symptoms. If less than 200, an immune system is called, it's little deteriorated. They define it, WHO define it as AIDS. For the treatment decision, normally if more than 350 CD4 counts, treatment is not recommended. Basically, treatment is recommended for those who have the CD4 counts less than 200 in the AIDS stage. Nowadays, they have started to initiate the treatment little early, between 200-350 cells per microliter, if they have that. In some doctors actually recommend this one to start early. Now, if we see when infection starts, there are basically, related to the treatment, there are basically four stages we should consider. First one is this. This virus, this is the cell, CD4 plus T cells. This virus that attaches, so that gp120 bind to the CD4 protein of these cells, receptors, and they bind. After they bind, actually in that gp120 is connected to the gp41, and that gp41 has the two portion, SR1 and SR2. When they connect, there is some conformational change of that protein, and there is due to that conformational change and interactions, there is a formation of some structure, and that structure will bring this virus membrane and cell membrane together, and the fusion takes place. After the fusion, this viral RNA goes to this here and goes to this cytoplasm, and after reverse transcriptase, then that changes into the viral DNA that forms the copies of the viral DNAs, and that goes to nucleus. After that, again, here, they go outside with the mRNA. So many things here. I would like to point out among them, main stage is this one. There the fusion takes place. There is a role of gp41. Second stage is this one, reverse transcriptase, in which viral RNA changes into a viral DNA. Next one, important one is also after when they assemble, they form all the requirements to make the new virus, and there is assembly takes place. In that case, at the beginning, only non-infectious virus are produced, and there is a protease protein that cleaves, that cuts that non-infectious part and makes the infectious virus. That I would like to point out those three stages mainly because drugs are related to those three stages. One is there are protease inhibitors. What that drug does is protease inhibitors actually prevent for cleaving that protease in this stage. Only non-infectious virus are produced. Infectious virus cannot produce. That protease inhibitor drugs does work act here. Another one is reverse transcriptase inhibitors. Another drugs that do not allow, that stops here, that do not allow going from RNA to DNA. Also Next drug, today I will be talking, there is only one drug approved by FDA, which is the fusion inhibitor that acts here actually. It acts outside the cell, and what it does is, like I mentioned before, there are HR1 and HR2 interaction, and this one drug I'll be talking, that fusion inhibitor drug, will, that's a small peptide that binds to that HR1 portion, so that this virus, that interaction cannot take place and this virus cannot go, the fusion cannot take place. That's why it's called fusion inhibitors. So, and now if we look general, yeah, this figure I think it might have been used million of times in almost anywhere actually, wherever. So this one, in general, when infection starts, what happens is this viral load, this blue curve is the viral load. Viral load goes down, the red curve is the viral load. Viral load goes up, rapidly it increases. When it becomes peak, people consider this peak is correlated with the immune system activations, and it goes down now slowly because of that immune systems, and it stays for a long time, many, many years, up to even 20 years. And finally, in the final stage, then there is a eight stages, this jumps up and finally there is death. And CD4 count goes like this. So this is the normal trend. So if we look at this one, there are clearly three stages of HIV. One is first stages, in which so many things are going on here. That is, first infection starts and virus goes very high and it comes down and it goes to the checkpoint stage. And once this stage is a long period, is the latent stage, and final period is the AIDS. So clearly, that can be divided into three stages: primary stage, clinical latency stage, and AIDS stage. So now, basically, we discussed two parts here: primary stage and AIDS here. First part is this primary stage. Okay, so in the primary stage, to model this viral dynamics, it's that model almost more than about 20 years, the model has been being used here. Existing model is T cells, people consider T cells because virus actually infect the T cells. And these T cells proliferate, that there is a recruitment, cell division and those kind of things. There's a recruitment of T cells and T cell will die. Then this virus, when it comes, this virus infects the cell with a certain rate. So this is infected cell, T star, and with a certain rate it infects, and with beta is the rate, and with beta TB it becomes infected. And this infected cell, of course, dies, and infected cells produces a lot of viruses. So, and this one, this dynamics, and virus also cleared out by so many things, like antibodies, responses, and also this one here is the immune responses. They all are incorporated in single parameters. So this is the dynamics which has been used for a long, long time. And actually from early stage to late stage, everywhere this model is used. And actually this model is very good actually. This works in most of the data actually. Nicely it works. So, but one thing I would like to point out here, this beta, which is the infection of the virus. Here, the infection, our infection here depends upon the viral load, T cells, and with a certain rate beta. And it is constant. It remains constant all the time. So we would like to modify that. Because we have now experiment here, HIV infection of macaques monkeys experiment. This experiment is kind of interesting. There are typically three groups of monkeys. The first group of monkeys, that what they have done in this experiment is, this donor monkeys, and donor monkeys are intravaginally infected by this stock virus, SIVMAC251, that's a stock virus. And it's very obvious that when they are infected, what happens is this. We know that, because virus goes up. Once they are sure that they are infected, and it goes up, and this pattern takes place. And in this experiment, what they have done is, first they take this pre-ramp up stage, that's first, after the beginning of this infection, first 2 weeks are pre-ramp up, and after first 2 weeks, two to four, five, 6 weeks, around that week, That's called the ramp-up stage. I would like to say only early stage. So this pre-ramp, they took the plasma from this pre-ramp-up stage, then they infected, intravenous inoculation of that to certain groups of monkeys. And later, and next, what they did is, they take the sample from blood from here, and they infected to another group. Yeah. So that means it is clearly, and they have counted how many virus actually they have infected. That's the one unique feature of this experiment. Normally they don't count how many virus goes inside the body. So here they have counted. And what they have found, and how they have done is they make the dilute series of dilution, like starting from 15 RNA copies, starting from one RNA copies, 3 RNA copies, 15, 150, they go on increasing and they catch on infecting it. So what they have found finally is these monkeys which are infected by this early virus, plasma virus, they 20 viral RNA copies in a whole body, total viral RNA copies they introduce is the 20 viral RNA copies that establish the infection. But these monkeys, that one, they could not infect with this number of less. They needed, they goes on increasing 20, 200 like this, and so they needed at least 50, they needed about 1500 viral RNA copies to establish infection. So they did for many, many monkeys, and what we see from here is, if we take the virus from here, normally they just count the virus in general for the patients, they just count the virus and they have a high virus and it's infectious, and they are low virus, it's non-infectious. But it is not the case here. If the virus is from this stage, even if it is 20, they are very infectious, they can establish the infection. And here, in the late stage, they need the more and more virus, because most of the virus are not that infectious. So that's why infectivity, that beta TV, what we use, that's the infection corresponding to the viral load only, does not work here. Like we discussed before also, probability transmission cannot be correlated with the viral load only, because it's important to say that early virus or late virus, they are different. So why it is like that? So what we can see from here is clearly early virus are very, very much more infectious than the late viruses. So why it is? There are two hypotheses in this experiment. They have given two hypotheses. One is this, during that reverse transcriptase stage of HIV, there are very high mutation. HIV is extremely high mutation. So, but mutation means it's an error. When they mutate, most of the times non-infectious virus produce. So if this in early stage, they don't get enough time to produce more and more non-infectious virus. So that's why whatever they produce, they are more infectious. And later stage, when they have a longer time and they replicate many, many, many cycles, then later many, many viruses are infectious. So in the later stage, there are many non-infectious viruses because they get enough time and enough cycle of mutations, so that many, many viruses are non-infectious here. That's one point. The first reason to be earlier virus are more infectious than the later virus is because they get more time to mutate. Mutate means producing non-infectious virus more. And second reason is very clear, because in later body starts to develop immune systems, and there are so many antibodies produced. That antibodies, because it takes a long time to produce the antibody, it doesn't get immediately shows up the antibodies. So that's why in the later, due to that antibodies, the virus becomes again not infectious. So that's why in the later, the virus in the later stage are non-infectious, less infectious compared to the early stage, because of these two reasons. So, and what we did is we developed a model. We started with a complicated model. We are still working considering that complicated model. What we have done in that model is we consider that fact, taking a long time and mutation fact, the time-dependent mutation rate, and also including the immune system, and we have actually 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensional models. We have that one, but this is Alan Perelson's normal style actually. What's the point of using complicated models if you don't have a data? So we don't have a data for immune systems, we don't have a data for antibody responses, so what's the point of complicating the models? So you basically get the same thing. That's why he always wants to very, very simplify the models. So we also want to take a very simple approach, that one. So we simplify the model, and I'm going to show only the simplified version. And plus, oh, I have to say one more thing. That's about the monkeys data. Now we have another data in HIV patients. It's very extremely difficult to get the primary blood samples in the HIV patients, actually, because we don't know when they got infected. So that's the first always difficulty. To catch in that early stages is extremely difficult. So we have this data. In this data, what they have done is they have compared the TCID 50, mean tissue culture infectious dose. So I mean, what they do is, if you infect, so how many viruses can infect at least 50%? Those kind of one kind of measurement there. They have compared for the early patients, and they have found that in this not only in monkey data, HIV infection, in HIV infection also, they have found that early viruses are more infectiousness. So this is the actually infectivity. It's not the viral load. It's the ratio of that TCID 50. How many viruses are infectious compared to the total viral load. So this ratio, this is the data, and it shows that, this is in log scale, so it shows that the virus, there is a clear decay from early to later stage infectiousness amount, proportion, infectiousness ratio of the infectious virus is decreases over the time. This is in the HIV patients. So then when we just do this linear fitting, we have roughly found that 0.3 per day is the exponential decay here. Decay rate is 0.3 per day. So 0.3 infectivity, that beta actually decreases 0.3 per day in that rate. So roughly. Now, so we just want to simple, we want to start with a very simple approach. We consider pre-ramp up rate, beta zero, and we consider set point rate beta infinity, because it cannot go to zero. There is always some kind of infectiousness, always limit beta infinity and the exponential slope, and we just take this beta like this. So when we take this data beta, so that we have a three data here, same data, donor animals, group of ramp up recipient means those who get the early blood samples in that experiment, and set point recipient animals mean those who get the later blood samples. And this data were provided by the California National Primate Research Center, University of California, and that HIV infectivity data that was provided by Duke University School of Medicine. And HIV, there is another data set we want to fit for the HIV patients, and that's obtained from the CHABI, the Center for HIV AIDS Vaccine Immunology. So we have three sets of data. Now we fit the data, and we estimate the key parameters. This rate curve, the blue curve is that our model with the beta beta depending upon time-dependent infectiousness, and this rate curve dotted line is the constant when we keep the beta constant. So we can see that model can fit data very well. This is for the recipient animals. This group is the early recipient. This group is the later blood recipient animals. And also we have this the HIV patients. So both we can fit the data, and the fitting is we find that in most of the cases, about 80% of cases, fitting with the beta constant is better. Not only visually it's better, and not only visually, we did F-test, a statistical test, and with that statistical test, we found that in 80% this beta time dependency is statistically significantly better. So then what we find here is, of course, yeah, we did model significant F-test, time dependent infectivity is significantly better. then this is what we got. After we get that, our beta looks like this. So it's for the all animals, and this is for the donor animals, ramp up recipient animals, and set point recipient animals. What we see here is actually plasma virus decays on average 8-fold lower. From early to state point stage, we have estimated 8-fold the virus infectivity can decrease. And that decay slope is, our estimation is 0.28 per day, which is actually very good, consistent with that experimental data, 0.3. And decay rate in the state point recipient animals is actually 16 times lower than this pre-ramp up recipient animals. And infection rate is higher in ramp up recipient animals. By ramp up, I mean the early. State point means the later. So infection rate is higher if somebody gets infected with the early virus, their infection is higher. If somebody is infected with the later virus, infection is lower. So we cannot simply say depending on the viral load or depending on the contact, we have to say the source depends on the source. So the person who is the source of the virus, it is in the early stage or it is in the later stage. So that part is, we have to consider that part too. So now, we just want to use this model to get some pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis. So that's just a short term. By pre, for, yes? I think this is, I'm saying both, I think. First thing is, when people get infected, at the time of infection, which one is more infectious depends on the source. Of course, source means, suppose this person, and this is the infection point, infection starts here, and at that point, is more infectious or not, that depends on, that's beta zero, early. More infectious or not, that depends on the this person, how many virus goes in. A plus, and which stage are they in? If,
I'm talking about the next stage.
Yes, no, I'm going to say that. The first thing, it depends on that, beta zero. Plus, once it gets infected, whatever source it is, once it gets infected, and again, it goes like this, but here also, this infectivity decays in every patient. For the transmission, also depends on the source. And once it gets infected inside the single body also, its infectivity is decays. Okay, yes, yeah. So this the idea is actually, in one sentence, what I want to say is, once a person gets infected, infectivity decays. In the single person. That's what I want to say now. I forget about that source. Maybe that made you a little confused about the source. Let's forget about the source. Once people get infected or animals get infected, the infectivity decays over the time. Yeah. And our estimation shows that it can decay eightfold. It can decay eightfold and it's by 0.28 per day. Yeah. Now we just quickly do some this optimal control therapy. For what when we use the therapy in this early stages, that's generally used for a pre or post exposure prophylaxis. That's given normally in a hospital setting or persons working in a hospital when they get stick needles with some patients who are HIV infected. So even though they don't know they are actually they will get infected or not, but they will be given some medicines they are given, so drugs are given. So here, effect of therapy will make this beta T decreases clearly because, yeah, this is the infectivity decreases when therapy is given. And also protease inhibitor, this production of virus decreases by epsilon. And we want to do drug efficacy actually. Concentration of C is the concentration of this, and this is the standard modal Because some concentration of drug is given, and what is its efficacy? What is the effectiveness? That is calculated by this Emax model. It's called C is the concentration, Emax is the maximum it can reach, and so, and this is the 50% infectious dose, IC50, and N is the Hill coefficient. This N varies based on the different drugs, actually. So, and this alpha is that's called the placebo effect. Sometimes even only vitamins are given, they will control themselves. So that kind of this placebo effect. But here, to make it simple, we just take Emax 1 and alpha, this eta, we vary between 0 and 1. And we would like to maximize here, because one of the goal of treating here is to maximize this T cell with the least therapy cost within a certain time interval. So then we would like to maximize this T, and this eta is the related to the concentration. So we want to minimize concentration, but that's equivalent to minimizing eta. So we just solve it, then what we see, here also we would like to see how there is an effect of time dependency or not. Actually, yes, this curve is TDI model, means time dependent infectiousness model. When you use time dependent, and CI model is the constant model. So there is a huge difference in the control, as well as there is a huge difference in the control of by this eta, it is the concentration of the drug required. So there is a huge difference. So when we do the optimal control therapy, so this time dependent in early phases, this time dependent infectiousness is important for the important to consider, and that difference increases based on beta. This B is associated with the cost, actually. Now, next thing we do here is, as we are talking about the early phase prophylaxis, but it's very natural that common to expect that we don't know when the infection starts, in fact. So that means our therapy initiation might be, it's not necessary that we always start from the zero point. So we can start from 1 week later, 2 weeks later, like that. So we do this optimal therapy for the variation times. So this is the optimal control for when therapy starts zero time, that is corresponding to pre-exposure prophylaxis, and post-exposures are corresponding to, suppose we start 1 week later, 2 week later, three, four and five, yeah. So if we start therapy at different times after the infection begins, then what we see here is, yeah, if we see the uninfected cell, if we start therapy early, so this 1,000 is the maximum of this 1,000 CD4 cell count. This CD4 cell count remains very high. But if we delay the therapy, this CD4 starts to drop. So this control is not that much effective. In the same way, if we see the viral load, yeah, the same, 0 week, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. If we start, these two dotted lines means we start the therapy and we stop. Because that PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, they are given only for 28 days normally. But we just do normally for the 2 months, actually. When this starts from here and it stops here, and what we see here, this scale is here, -4, so it's already below the, I should have drawn one line here, detection level actually. This is already below the detection level. So what we see from here is this actually. If this optimal, to get the optimal achievement of the therapy, early initiation is necessary. If therapy initiation is early enough, then there is a well control of the therapy. If it is delayed like this, so there is already a peak viral load and a higher viral load remains. So therapy is not as effective as. So when the therapy starts is important. This is pretty much about the first part. Now this second part is completely different actually. It's the chronic late infection. In the second part we discuss it, late infection. What we particularly discuss here is treatment during chronic phase. There is one drug, fusion inhibitor. It is also called T20, and it is also called infuvirtide. What this drug does is, this is our infection. So as I already discussed here, what this drug does is, here when they are attached, This SR1 region and S2R region has to interact, and this infiltrator drug is it's a 36 amino acids peptide that will go inside the body and bind in that SR1 region, and there is no interaction, and this fusion event is blocked here. So that's my one unique feature of this drug compared to all other drugs is it acts outside. It doesn't act inside like this. It acts outside the cell. So the first FDA approved fusion inhibitors actually. So, but it's expensive and must administer parenterally. And another thing is it's often reserved for heavily treated patients with limited therapeutic option. That means it is given in a very, very late stage patient. So almost CD4 count is 100, that kind of. It's in the worst situation, this one is given. And this one is given, it's very effective if given in combination with two or more other drugs. If it is given only one, it's not effective. But if it is given in combination with, that's called a background regimen, if it has certain other drugs background regimen, if it is given, and it is very effective. So, and of course, as usual, for other drugs, emergence of resistance is always the problem here in this infiltrator drugs also. So, when its resistance emerges, it results in substantial decrease in antiviral activity. How it emerges is actually among this, that SR1 portion, there is a change in amino acid, and so that the infiltrator drug cannot bind to that SR1 portion. So it cannot work as usual. So there is a resistance. And virologic failure, this is also important actually, virologic failures often have a consequence of ENF interruption. It's because of this one. Because it is often reserved for a heavily pretreated patients with limited therapeutic option, means if this drug doesn't work, then doesn't work, finished. So there is no options actually. So it has to be stopped actually. So, but people have found something that even though there is a resistance and it doesn't work properly, but there is some benefit of the immune system. So there is a question that despite emergence of resistance, there is a benefit of re-administering ENF. So that's why what people sometimes suggest that interrupted therapy is a possible therapy option. I mean, just to give the drugs, it doesn't work. It's completely, all the resistant virus will grow. So then you stop it. And after some time, that resistant virus will die and again give them. And interrupted therapy might be the options for this one. So in this case, we have very limited data actually. Viral load data, this data has two data sets, sensitive virus and resistance virus, both data sets, and that's also during ENF interruption as well as during re-administrations. And we have only for the three patients, unfortunately. And here, the key questions for this drug is, during ENF interruption, so once ENF is given and when it is interrupted, in the during absence of ENF, ENF resistance waxes rapidly, it decreases rapidly with the rapid growth of wild-type virus. So when drug is stopped, ENF resistance goes down, but wild-type virus or sensitive virus comes up. What plays the role for that turnover of the population? That's one key question. Another question, experimentally what they have found is, even though ENF virus, this wild-type virus comes up and resistant virus goes down, but if we sum up them, total plasma virus load remains almost a constant. So what factors play a role in determining plasma viral loads? So again, ENF re-administration, re-administration given, opposite happens. Wild-type virus grows and becomes dominant. So it's not grows actually. Wild-type virus decreases and becomes... not wild type actually, this is opposite of this first one. Yeah, when it is given again, here ENF resistance went, but here this is ENF resistance grows and becomes dominant. And so what factors play a role in dust turnover during ENF re-administration? And is there any advantage of re-administering ENF? So there are actually so many questions related to this ENF drugs. So now we just start with this simple model. In this model, what we have included is First question we would like to discuss is, when drug is stopped, this wild-type virus goes off and this resistant virus goes down. It decays. Why is that? Basically, there are two hypotheses. One is, one experiment shows that this fitness cost, one hypothesis is that fitness cost might be because resistant virus are less fit. They are not as equal fit as sensitive virus. So that fitness cost actually determines that factor, that plays a role for the decay of that resistant virus. The second, another one experiment shows that particularly, that experiment is unusual actually, particularly for this fusion inhibitor, they have done gene sequences and like that, and from that the sequence analysis, what they have found is, it's not because of fitness cost only, actually basically that's because due to the backward mutation. So resistant, wild-type virus, when they mutate, they become resistant virus, and there is still continuous evolution, and that resistant virus again go back to the, becomes the sensitive virus, wild-type virus. The backward mutation also play roles. So it's not known well that what actually plays the role, which one is important factor. That's why we have included this one, which is the forward mutation. This epsilon S is the efficacy of the drug. This is the same here. This forward mutation, phi S portion goes from, this one is the total infection by this TS, by this sensitive virus, and among them, forward mutate by phi S and remaining remains here. And similarly, this one is by the resistant virus, and this portion is the backward mutation. This portion is the backward mutation. So we have considered backward mutation also here, and fitness cost is here, beta R. We do in a beta R, some people do in PS. Here it's reasonable to be doing a beta R because it's a fusion inhibitor and it acts outside. So this alpha is the fitness cost. What we have assumed here is this infectivity of resistant virus is alpha, it's less than beta S. So we would like to estimate this alpha and this all parameters, and we would like to see which one is important. So during ENF interruption, three patients are given the drugs and they are interrupted, and we do the data fit. So this is the fitting of our model. This red one is resistant virus, green one is sensitive virus, wild type virus. So fit looks good actually. Yeah. And by this fitting, we have estimated the parameters. What we have found is backward and forward mutation rates are actually comparable. So that means it supports that second gene analysis study, which says that there is a continuous evolution. Evolution goes on continuously, and backward mutation also plays a role. So they are comparable, so it is. But in addition to that, what we have found is only, even though there is a backward mutation comparative to a forward mutation, but this only these things is not enough for that rapid decrease of resistance and growth of wild-type virus. So this fitness cost plays important role than that. So, and we have estimated this, that particular resistance to this fusion inhibitor is 15% less fit than actually sensitive virus. So effect of fitness cost. Now, if we look at the fitness cost, it's interesting. This picture is actually, it's a total viral load. And among this total, how much, what is the portion, this B38A is the mutant virus, resistant one. What is the percentage of resistance here from 100? It was 100% at the beginning. Because they were given drugs for about 38, 39 weeks. So they all have a resistance only. So it was almost 100% at the beginning. So later, when they stop drug here at zero, so then this decreases. Now, here we have taken different fitness costs. This one, what we see is, interestingly, whatever the fitness cost is, total viral load always remains the same. So fitness cost doesn't have a role in maintaining the viral load. So here, and what fitness cost does is actually it turnovers the virus. So if with a virus load is fitness cost is 20 means more fit, more fitness cost means less fit. If less fit, then this decreases rapidly. And if we more fit, this then decreases slowly. So that means how long that resistant virus takes to turn over, then that is decided by this fitness cost. But one will decrease, another will increase, there is a competition, but fine, the total always remains almost the same. Now, effect of T cell recruitment, that's lambda, because goal of these viruses are to infect the T cells. So whether there is enough T cell or not, that plays very important role for their survival. So that's why, what does this T cell recruitment does? We change this T cell recruitment lambda. So then what we see here is, this is same figure, the right and left same. This is total viral load and this is same proportion of resistance. When it's below 50, that means it turns over another one. So it comes, another one becomes dominant. So this is resistance. So what we see here is, for the turnover, this T cell doesn't play much role. But this determination of plasma viral, whether they have larger viral load or smaller viral load, that hugely depend on this lambda. That means T cell availability, how many T cells are, how many T cells are recruited. So another thing we did in the re-administration, now what they have done, we have very limited data for this one actually. They stopped the drugs for again 2 years or something like that, and they again re-administered only for 4 weeks. So we have data for only 4 weeks. So we estimate, again fitted the data, we have only 4 or 5 data points only in that case. Same, here the opposite happens. This resistance goes up and this sensitive virus comes down. So, and we estimated here again, and our estimation shows that this ENF efficacy is 74% for the sensitive virus and it is only 25% less for the resistant virus. And effect of this ENF efficacy to resistance virus, so if this efficacy increases, it becomes more and more effective to the resistance virus also. So here, this is same figure, it's the plasma total viral load and this is the proportion of the resistance. Here, there is again not much different role in maintaining this total viral load, but there is a huge effect during this re-administration, there is huge effect in turnover of the virus population. So now, is there any benefit of re-administration? So what we wanted, benefit means always mostly T cell benefit, always that has to take into account because that's important. So we counted T cell counts when, if the virus, this is without ENF re-administration, suppose it's without, it goes like that, and if ENF is re-administered, even though it is not effective in controlling viral load, but there is a benefit of the T cell counts. If there's, it is more and more, if the ENF is re-administered, this viral load will become, this T cell will remain the higher. So that means to maintain the higher T cells, it is better to give ENF even though it doesn't work. It doesn't work to control the virus, but it works to control the immune cell. The reason for this is, what it does is when ENF is given, it actually kills the sensitive virus. But it cannot do anything to resistant virus, will grow. But it kills the sensitive virus, which are actually infectious. Sensitive virus are actually infectious. So when ENF, even though there is a problem of resistance, but giving drug continuously, so interrupted drug is good, because it suppresses the infectious viruses and it allows that those less infectious resistant virus to grow. And when it is too much, then it is stopped and again give them. So when it is stopped, that sensitive virus will come out, which are more infectious, then again give this ENF that will control the sensitive virus. virus. So that's why there is some benefit, immune system benefits. Now, that's what I would like to say actually, basically. In the primary phase, what we have done is virus infection decays 8-fold over the course of infection, decay rate is 0.28. The infectivity depends upon the source of virus infection, maybe this source again. Time-dependent infectiousness need to be taken into account for optimal control. Early initiation is important. Now in the chronic phase, yeah, these are the answer for those questions based on our analysis and data fitting, actually, I should say that. Nothing, because this is just the 3 patients, so we can say it's 100% reliable, actually. Yeah, there is always question. So forward and backward mutations are comparable. Fitness cost is the most important factor for virus population. How fast another virus will take over, fitness cost is important. And during ENF interruption, but during ENF readministration, efficacy of drugs is important. And T cell recruitment rate is important for a plasma viral load level, total viral load level. ENF readministration provides T cell count benefit, actually. So we have here, I would like to acknowledge this. This research is supported by U.S. Department of Energy under this contract, NIH grant, all Allen's grant, actually. Yeah. So this, yeah, and so I would like to thank to these people who provided the data, California National Primary Research and Duke University School of Medicine. Okay, I'll be happy to discuss if you have any questions.
Somewhere kind of in the middle of the
change. That's constant, okay. I forgot to tell actually. That dotted line, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to tell what is that dotted line actually. So what we did is in our data set for all 14 animals yes, this one, right? This one, yeah. Yes, exactly. I forgot to explain this clearly, actually. First of all, we have, these are just animals. We did also for HIV patients. So there are 14 animals, and we did data fitting of our model for all 14 animals, and also data fitting for constant model for all 14 animals. And constant model gives constant beta, so these dotted lines are constant beta. So this the dotted lines comes from that constant infectivity, and these solid lines are our model. Now what we did here, we again wanted to compare that source with the source we want to compare, whether it depends on source or not, we want to compare. So we separated three. Donor, this red one is donor animals, and this ramp up recipient animals is the blue one, and set point recipient animals is the green one. So what we see here is blue curves. This actually, that's why this we say this ramp up and set point means as entirely they depend on the source actually. They are completely different source they have got. One got 20 RNA copy from the early, and another got 1500 RNA copy from the late stage. So then what we see here is this slows really, really slowly decays. Yes.
And the same for the red and the same for what you get together. But it seems surprising that when you allow this thing to decay, then your best fit is totally below the constant decay rate. Why is that?
Yeah, I was also kind of surprised when I got that, because I actually independently I fitted, and that is the best fit I got. So that's, but you are right. So normally we expect this, right, in the middle.
What did you do in the sensitivity analysis? So looking at sensitivity of the
Yeah, I have actually calculated the confidence interval as well. Yeah, I have calculated confidence interval, and I did the sensitivity. Basically, I had to do the sensitivity for donor animals. We don't know what is the initial viral load, right? So we know for this one, the ramp up recipient is 20 of the whole body. So we know for the set point, that's 1500, but we don't know donor. That's why I did sensitivity for the donor animals. And but this one, sensitivity by sensitivity, what? I just keep the here C. C means that's a viral load constant. And I did sensitivity for that. By sensitivity, you mean change that one, and again, see the how much it changes fitting, right? So, yeah.
It's really about fit, but you know, it can change by quite a lot, so yeah, always.
That's the one thing possible. Because this one, these animals have very less data. Yes, that's exactly, we can see that. That's possible, that's available. Because this, what they did, yes, I'll show you. Yes, that's exactly true. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, these animals have, well, some have only four. That's why there is always that question. It's very valid question, yes, actually. Yes, there's only four. This one is okay. This one is, yes. This four is making a little bit problem, I guess. Yeah, that's one. But that's what I got. But I tried that in three different softwares independently, like Buckley Medina, and Las Alamas has one, FUI. They are very good, very fast, even to get confidence interval and everything. I tried FUI, and of course, always, so I start with MATLAB, actually. So when I did all those things, approximately, I got the same thing. That's why, yeah. But I agree with you, this is questionable, because there are only four data points. You can think of going like this, anything you can think of, right? So that's always, yeah.
In the talk, you alluded to this, but you didn't go into the specifics. There's a huge mystery about HIV, and that even at the height of AIDS, no more than 1 in 200 CD4 T lymphocytes are infected with HIV. So how does that end up killing all the other CD4 T cells when only 1 in so many cells are infected? What theory did they propose to explain it? I mean, you can't just say apoptosis and this and that and the other. I mean, what precise mechanism? I only 1 in so many cells are infected.
Sorry, I didn't get the question. One more time, please. I kind of. Yeah.
No more than 1 in 200.
Yes. Yeah.
So what theory would you propose as to how all the cells end up dying because of HIV when only 1 in so many are
affected? That's. I don't think I can really answer that question very well. But in our feeding also, what we have done is, in our feeding also, in HIV patients feeding also, what we have done is, you're right, not one, basically, there is one experiment that only one, even not infected, only one percentage of the total CD4K cells get activated, actually, even not infected. Only 1% of the total CD4 cells get activated, and that's only become the target cell. So in our HIV data fitting, we have also used that 1%. That's why in this data fitting, in this HIV data fitting, our total T0, initial target cell, human body has around 10 to the power 6 T cells per micro per milliliter. That is 1,000 per microliter, but we have used here only 10,000 at the beginning. 10,000, it's because only 1% get activated, and you're right, only very limited are infected. But again, why kill? I don't think I can say anything. I have no knowledge about that one. Yeah, that's but that's true, actually.
There's been no progress, no theories presented by others?
To my knowledge, I don't know. I should say it that way. Actually, there might have been. It's a so huge research, and there's a very different groups working on T cells, different group working on B cells. So many things going on. So that's why I have not looked at in that direction. Thank you. Oh, it's like that. Well, they did the experiment. They infected 20, two number of animals. They infected 20 and they waited. Every day they check. They check every day and they got the, they got that one. And so other one, that 1501, They did with 20, they waited, didn't work, and again do little bit increase, they did, didn't work, and they kept doing, and finally when they gave 1500, all got infected. So this is how, always there is a little bit, not exact like mathematics, so this experiment is always, there's a question about
it.
I think that makes the thing is the reason in the 1500 is was that even though there are 1500 viruses, all are not infectious because of the environment. We are not saying here that virus itself, if I take one virus from early phase and one virus from late phase, this one is more infectious and this one is not more is not less infectious. No, we are not saying that. They are, might be equally infectious. Only thing, this one virus is just fresh, everything is new, so they haven't got anything. But here, they faced with the antibodies and so many things, the mutation, so many things. That's why these viruses are less infectious. So that means, if we take one, no, it doesn't work. It's not like that. Okay. So, but that's a very good question, actually. So that's why they have done one more experiment. What they have done one more experiment is they took the early virus and mixed with the later environment, actually. Like they did some heat inactivated. I am not very good in explaining those kind of things, experimenting. They did the late environment, I mean antibodies, those pregen. When they mix up that and pregen as a plasma and give, then they didn't get infected. Because of the environment, actually. It's not because of the virus itself. Beta?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just the exponential function. Exponential function, but it doesn't go to zero. Exponential from beta zero to some set point level. There are three parameters, actually, even slow. Three parameters. Two extra parameters, I should say, rather than constant, there are two extra parameters. Yes, yeah. Beta zero, beta infinity, and k. So how it changes slopes. Yeah.
One of the, just the other day, I was on the radio, they were saying about some new vaccines for HIV. Otherwise, I wouldn't put an end to the model.
There are so many, actually. There are some other vaccines they call, Robert Smith also has done some work, right? So they call the vaccine, but that's like a drug, actually. Every time they give, but that's vaccine, basically, because they stimulate CD4, CD8 plus cells instead of like a drug. So, yeah.
I actually had a question about the model of the primary infection.
Yeah. You are saying when you give 15 or 20, whatever, 20, you should not take 20? Is that because some are lost?
If you go to your model, your equation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, here you mean? Here? That one, they found it is important for influenza, you know that. They have included that. But this decrease of virus, this portion, decrease of virus, that will change the C, right? Basically, that we can incorporate in C. I mean, roughly.
I'd like to see it done with that term there.
Minus beta TV or minus beta dash TV. Exactly same. Why exactly same? I would prefer. Yes, I like that one because. When in fact virus will go inside the cell and that will lose, virus will be lost. I completely agree with you, but I would prefer some other constant because the rate, this is the rate for the target cell loss, and this is the rate, the whatever we put here will be the rate for the virus loss, right? Maybe different rate, but have anybody done for HIV? How important will that be? But I know for influenza, I think that plays a little role. You were right. For influenza, I know that plays a little role. Yeah. But HIV, oh, I haven't tried for sure, so I don't know. But what I did is, I have done sensitivity for C. And that doesn't make that much difference in parameter estimation. So that can answer something. So this might not be that important. So because I have changed the C I took is 23. So, but I changed that from the half to the 36 because normally 9 to 36 is the present day. In 2000, around 2000, it used to be 3 only, but later they have found now it's very fast viral decay, so 23. So I use 23 here, but I have done sensitivity over C, so but that didn't make little percentage only, that didn't make that much difference in the parameter estimation. So that's why, I don't know, but it's still, I haven't used that one.
I think you suggested that an explanation for the changing data was to do with the cells becoming different to the what is the explanation? What's the
beta? Why beta changes over time?
Yes.
So there are two reasons.
Yes.
One is beta is the infectivity. Yes. I would like to say. Here, so by infectivity, let's say proportion of infectious virus over total.
Right.
So let's say like it. So then that's the beta, in fact. So in our, I said we have developed a complicated model that gives, yeah.
Because you have to add two more parameters to your model anyway.
Yeah.
To have to change the beta. Would it be the same complexity to just incorporate kind of what you did to the end bit where you have kind of the infectious virus and the less infectious virus? Why don't
two populations of virus here,
and then... Oh, two populations
of virus here? Yeah. That's what, when in the complicated models, yeah, that's what we have. Two populations of virus, infectious and non-infectious. Okay. And certain portion goes to become the non-infectious. But that also time-dependent. The reason is it doesn't, with the constant, because... Suppose if the 5% virus become non-infectious, if we can use the constant, in early, if there are 100 virus, 5 of becomes infectious, non-infectious, but later, if there are 500 virus, it's not 25, it's more, because there are antibody responses, and plus, there are more mutations, because so many more mutation cycles will make it, even that going... that's what we exactly did, considering infectious and non-infectious two viruses, but again, that's time-dependent, yes.
Yeah.
which one is B? Which B you are saying? What is B? Okay.
Over time, with mutation, your Q is actually.
Yes, probability. Yes, that's right. Not only mutation, we have a combination of antibodies responses also, actually. What we have is, under the model is, this V infectious and V non-infectious. This V infectious, 1 minus epsilon V infectious, 1 minus, this beta TV will go to here. Suppose this is infectious, beta TV will, this pi T, and there is 1 minus epsilon, that epsilon pi T goes here, right? So if, another, when we have considered two, this is one V, and VI infectious and V non-infectious, among them, whatever produced becomes infectious, certain, some percentage of this becomes non-infectious. And we have that as a time varying also. So I haven't used that particular P beta kind of probability thing. There also we use that with a certain rate, certain virus becomes, this virus actually, this is the new virus produced, pi T. So instead of pi T, I write here 1 minus epsilon pi T, that epsilon pi T becomes, pi T stats becomes infectious. And that epsilon again depends upon time because of that mutation. And my antibodies will come here because separate term for the antibodies. Antibodies will make neutralizing antibodies, by antibodies I mean, yeah. That neutralizes the virus, makes it non-infectious. Yeah.
Okay, you know, there's some which you can put in.
Yeah.
So you can maybe talk to Naveen afterwards.
Yeah.
Let's thank
Naveen. Okay, thank you very much.